Well, welcome to another episode of DevOps Dimension. In this episode, I have Josh here from PushPay to talk to us about blameless postmortems.
Hey, Tiago.
How are you, Josh?
I'm good.
Good. So I guess we could start by just understanding about PushPay, who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm the VP of engineering at PushPay, and I run a team of about 30, 40 engineers and testers and whatever else. Yeah. And we build the core systems that PushPay has. So we provide payment services for our customers. And at the moment, most of our customers are churches in North America.
Right.
And we've gone very, very rapid growth. So I started just over 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Joined a team of two engineers. Two of us started the same day. Right. So we went from 2 to 4. We're now at 30 in 2 years, or 35 in 2 years.
That's really quick growth.
Yep, yeah, quick growth. The whole product team's gone from 4 to 50. And our revenue's gone from about 50,000 ARR to about 16 million ARR in that period. So
cool.
It's been a bit of a ride.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we were discussing before, you've started this whole idea of blameless postmortems at PushPay.
Yeah, I introduced the idea. Yeah. So when I started, the team were using sort of Scrum-ish kind of lifecycle management. They had a big release about once a month normally. And it was common, or at least anecdotally common, for that release to be quite lumpy. It was a difficult release. Quite often there'd be issues that were discovered post-production that weren't great. And so the first public release we made after I got there went quite badly. There were some database migrations that hadn't been tested properly, and we had scrambled around and got it fixed. It didn't take long to recover, but I was like, we need to make this better.
Right.
And I'd been doing kind of some continuous delivery stuff on the side already, and so I was quite keen to get continuous delivery into the culture at PushPay.
Yeah.
But what I realized is, in order to do that, we had to have this continuous learning culture and this blameless culture in order to make it safe, because you can't do lots of changes to a payment processing system if you're scared for your job.
Yeah.
you've got to be confident that, okay, it's safe to make mistakes, and the blast radius of the mistakes is minimized. And so how do we do that? So we did this first deploy, and it didn't go great. And so we did a postmortem afterwards, and we all sat around a table, and we talked through what had happened. Someone wrote notes. And that was the start of that cultural change for us, that was like, okay, like, when we make a mistake in production, we're going to sit down and intentionally learn from it and try and figure out how we can do better next time. What's gone wrong? How's it gone wrong? And what can we do better
going forward? The motivation you had was, I guess the end goal was to be able to enable continuous delivery to production and not have people be worried about what
people already get worried when they come to work for us, because that's payments. And most engineers haven't done payments before. Right. It's kind of mysterious, and there's black boxes.
It's one of those areas.
It's one of those areas, right? And, you know, it's not people's lives, but it's people's money, so it's kind of the next most important thing.
Yeah.
So there's already a high degree of anxiety. And we wanted to be able to move faster, and we were still a very early stage startup at that point in time. And so what we wanted to do was say, hey, we need to get product to market as quickly as we can. We'd established kind of product market fit in the business. We wanted to know, okay, like, we need to get these features into customers' hands as quickly as possible, or at least into our salespeople's hands, so they can close deals.
Right.
We need to get our velocity up. How are we going to do that? And continuous delivery seemed like a really great strategy for doing that, and I had a little bit of experience with it already. But in order to make that safe, it wasn't good enough to go, oh, we're just going to push builds to production all the time, and there's no process for making sure that things are safe and better, right? So it was like, how do we make everyone comfortable with the idea that we're going to move faster, but we're actually going to move safer? And the theory and the practice, in practice it's true, that if you deliver small increments of change to production more rapidly, you actually have less chance of encountering a severe bug, right? Yeah. Because it's not a huge complex change set, but it's a really small delta, what's what we call it.
And that, I guess, because there are smaller changes, that makes it easier to do a postmortem as
That's
well.
That's exactly right, because the total set of possible causes is much, much smaller normally.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's cool. What steps do you follow when, now that you have it in production already, and then you find a problem?
Yep.
What happens after
what
that?
What does that look like?
PushPay at least?
So we don't have really, really rigid guidelines for what initiates a postmortem.
Yeah.
Quite often a postmortem will be started because someone will say, oh, we should probably do a postmortem about this.
Right.
Sometimes we'll do postmortems for things that aren't even in production. Like if we're unable to deploy for a few hours, we might do a postmortem to say, hey, how do we make this better? But anything that impacts production users should have a postmortem.
Right.
And so
that's a pretty
important baseline feature. Like, did it impact the ability to make payments? Did a customer see an error screen? Or was there some felt impact in production? Did our support channel hear about it? So we'll start the postmortem process. So the way we've done this has changed. The very first one, we sat around a table, but I like to talk a lot. I'm a loud, talker.
Yeah.
And so what I found was that the conversation was dominated by the people that talked the most. and that people that actually had really valuable things to say kind of got drowned out by the bigger personalities in those conversations. Right. So the process has evolved. We moved it into online chat, which meant that the people that weren't necessarily naturally assertive socially could still interject into the conversation. And then we've moved on from that subsequently to actually having a process where the people that were involved, normally it's one or two people, kind of incident responders, will fill in a wiki template of a postmortem for us. And so that has kind of four main sections. It's got like a really simple one or two sentence summary of what happened and what the impact was. So this is roughly what happened. Like, we couldn't process Amex payments for 2 hours, and, you know, 27 users were affected by this, and, you know, or two customers or whatever it is. So like a high level impact for management.
Right.
And then we do a detailed timeline. So right from when the change that caused the problem was introduced through discovery, through the immediate incident response, like how do we find it, how do we fix it, and who was involved in all those things. And we're looking just to capture like who was involved, what they knew, what assumptions they had, what data they had access to. So if they were accessing our metric system, then, you know, we'll include stuff around that. We quite often link to Slack conversations. We have DevOps channels and incident response channels that we use. So there's a lot of data that exists during an incident that we can go back and pull out into this template.
Right.
And then there's a discussion section, which is a chance for everyone to come and contribute. So they'll normally write up the timeline, and then they'll publish it. So we have a channel in Slack called Morg, which is where we discuss postmortems. And so they'll post that kind of proto postmortem in there, and they say, I've finished this. If you've got stuff you want to contribute, can you read through? And so some people go, oh, actually, you've missed some stuff in the timeline. Like, I was doing this, or I know so-and-so was doing that. And then people will say in the discussion section, all right, it would have been really good if we had metrics to monitor this particular subsystem. We weren't monitoring this queue length on this thing, and we need to know how long that is, and we should have had alerts on it. So there'll be a discussion in this section where it's like, if we'd had this, it would have been better. Right. We would have been able to discover it more quickly, or we would have been able to diagnose and fix it more quickly. Mm. And then following that normally takes about a day for people to kind of get around to contributing.
Yeah.
And it all happens quite asynchronously now, so it's just happening by people editing wiki pages and occasionally a little discussion in Slack. Mm. Yeah. And then at the end of that, the person, the incident responders will then pull out what we call the mitigations, which are specific tickets assigned to specific individuals that can be done normally in less than five working days, definitely in less than 30 days. They should never be open longer than that. Occasionally, a postmortem will discover a major deficiency where we actually need to start a project to address it. We need to build a new subsystem, or we need to do a major piece of work. So that's not a mitigation. That's we need to discuss the value of that versus the cost of it and schedule it. But tickets, postmortem mitigation tickets, should be able to be done quite quickly. Mm. And they're your top priority. So after a postmortem, if you discover a mitigation and you create the ticket, then you basically pause your existing work queue and you address whatever it is. Because the idea is that this is going to help us prevent or discover or respond more easily to something later. So
And so going back to the times of when a postmortem is initiated.
Yep.
You mentioned, of course, any problem in production kicks one off.
Yep.
What other examples do you have there? You mentioned non-production things as well.
I mean, so there are occasionally situations that happen where we end up blocking our deployment orchestration pipeline because we can't make things all the way through.
Okay.
And so we'll quite often do a postmortem for that. It doesn't happen that frequently, but it does happen. Occasionally, because we do payments, payments is actually really an integration problem. And so we talk with a lot of third parties, like a lot of third parties. Yeah. And so quite often they'll go down.
Yeah.
And like, we're not offline, but we're unable to process some types of payments, or something's gone wrong somewhere downstream.
Yeah.
We'll do a postmortem even though like we haven't done anything wrong. But because quite often there's improvements we can make either to our monitoring and detection, or we can make build more resiliency into our platform to say, hey, you know, when this provider goes down, we can actually queue these types of payments and then replay them later once they come back up, rather than just telling users that they have to go away and come back.
Right.
So it's not necessarily because of something that we've done, but it's just like how, like really the bar for me for a postmortem is there something we can learn?
Mm.
Right. And if it seems like there's any possibility at all that we can learn, then we should try and do this process and see if there's any learnings.
You have that documented.
Yep.
So that you can learn from it.
Well, the point that the learning for me is, okay, like there's some simple things that we can do that make this better. That's the mitigations. Mm. Yeah. So the mitigations for me just end up building this whole infrastructure of this fabric that supports rapid change and means that it's safer to do stuff, because you know that the most common types of mistakes are already covered by monitoring and metrics and logging and tests or whatever else.
And What did you notice that you had to change in order to get you to trust people with deploying the, you know, letting them deploy to production and then not blaming anyone when there's something wrong?
So that's been a journey for us. And I think we started off where there were a few kind of blessed people that could hit the deploy to production button.
Right.
And they were the special, you know, chosen ones.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, oh, I'm really nervous about this. And so we underwent this process of cultural change because our deployment process by this point, so this is about August 2014.
Yeah.
Our deployment process was fully automated. We could do it online, so there was no outage required. It was just hitting a button. Mostly it was pretty robust.
Right.
But there was still this fear, well, it's production and it's payments and everything else. So what we ended up doing was saying, hey, look, we have a high trust environment. We've got very, very capable people. Anyone should be able to deploy to production at any time. There's enough automation, enough automated tests, and enough rigor in our deployment process that we can be confident this is going to work. So what we ended up doing is deciding that we were going to cycle the responsibility for production deployments around every member of the team. So each week for about 6 months, a different person took responsibility that week for actually doing the production deploys.
Right.
And they were just like, okay. Mm-hmm. We built a little run book and we said, okay, like this is what you need to check beforehand. These are the things you need to ensure.
Yeah.
This is how you recover from the various kinds of errors that we know about that can happen if we do a production deploy. Okay, it's your job to hit the button. And so everyone was in a situation where someone had done it the week before, so there was a little bit of social pressure to do it.
Right.
And they were like, oh, actually, this isn't as scary as I thought. Like, yep. And sometimes things go wrong, and the whole thing is when things go wrong, you're not going to be blamed or punished.
Right.
It's just an opportunity to say, hey, well, like, how can I help avoid someone else being in this situation?
And how did that work to have someone responsible for the deployments every once in a while?
It worked very well in terms of enculturating people to the idea that this wasn't some special mystical power or some special knowledge that you had to sort of seek to get, you know, the understanding.
Is that because a lot of it was automated?
Yeah, it was very automated. And the whole point is that as we continued to spread that responsibility around, it became clear, oh, there's things that are missing that we could automate that aren't automated. There's things that you have to manually, you have to know, you have to manually check.
Yeah.
And so it was like, all right, we can smooth this out. We can smooth, you know. So we just ended up showing the kind of lumpy bits in our process and forcing us to drive automation through where we didn't have it.
It almost sounds to me like striving for continuous delivery helps you do postmortems and then vice versa.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be really unfair to say to a team, hey, you're going to do continuous delivery, but in a blameful environment. I just don't see how that works culturally, because why would I ever make any change to production?
Right.
If my job's at risk, right?
If there's that barrier.
Yeah, there, that's right. You know, so I think it has to start from that sense of, hey, we trust you. We assume that everyone here is a good operator, you know, that you're not maliciously trying to break things. So that's our starting assumption, and then work forward from there to, if something went wrong, clearly there's a process problem or a system problem that needs to be addressed.
Cool. What happens when you introduce someone new to the team?
Like
you said you grew a lot, you know, over the past couple of years.
Yep.
How do you introduce people to this idea?
Yeah, so we still do it. We're still small enough that we can do it via oral tradition.
Right.
We just started moving away from that recently. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, I think it depends on the individual. And so some personalities are willing to take responsibility for things naturally. They're kind of naturally, oh, yeah, this is always my fault. You know, when some people are kind of more inclined to deflect blame naturally. So you have to coach people in different directions. People that are willing to take responsibility, you have to say, hey, look, the hardest thing about postmortems is not blaming yourself.
Right.
And it's really easy. And the one of the nice things in my team is that my whole team know that of anyone that works for PushPay, I've made the biggest mistake in production that anyone will ever make, right? So they all know the story of that postmortem is a public postmortem with all the other ones.
So that's the story you tell everyone.
So everyone knows that story, right? So it's kind of easy. It's like, well, Josh did this really stupid thing, right? And, you know, he still works here, so how bad can it be, right? But for some other people that deflect blame, you have to say, hey, look, part of the blameless postmortem culture is taking responsibility for what you did, right? You have to take responsibility for the fact that you did this thing, and I don't believe you did it intentionally, you weren't malicious, but there's things to learn. Help us learn by helping understand what you understood you were doing at the time you were doing it, what assumptions you had, and what information we could have surfaced to you that would have made it less likely for you to make the choices that you did. So.
And I bet that also forms a pretty good team culture.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, selfishly, yeah. I think our team culture is rubbish. No, it's great. I think it's really, really healthy.
I mean, it would help you get a little bit more closer to each other.
Yeah, and I mean, we're at the point now where we actually celebrate people's first postmortems.
Right.
We don't celebrate the fact that something went wrong, that it impacted users or impacted customers. But we celebrate the fact that they've actually done something big enough, a change has impacted enough that it made a difference in production, and we had something to learn from it. So.
Right. Cool.
Yeah.
And when you're talking about DevOps, we talk a lot about measuring things and metrics and et cetera.
Yep.
What specifically related to postmortems, what do you measure? What are some metrics that you have?
The top line thing that we measure, and it's really for management and the executive team, is impact. So what were users impacted, how many users, how many customers, unique customers were impacted. If we impacted payments, how many payments were impacted, what value were they, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that's been really interesting to watch that evolving as a concern, and having to teach the team, this is how you measure the business impact of a technical decision is really good, right? Because it makes it easy to see. So that's one thing that I care about a lot, is like in a month, how many postmortems actually had a material impact to, you know, real things, whether it's customers or users. But then the other things that I'm really interested in are the mean time to detection. So how long did it take from the change being introduced to us knowing something was broken in production?
Right.
And a lot of our postmortem mitigations end up getting focused on that, is trying to narrow that window down.
Right.
So certainly when you look back 12 or 18 months at our postmortem, sometimes that mean time to detection was very long, like weeks.
Right.
and now that's generally much, much shorter. Right. You know, it's a couple of days would be exceptional, and normally a few hours. Mm. And then the next thing is mean time to resolution, like, you know, how long did it take from discovering we had a problem to being able to remediate it? And for us, quite often remediating in the short term is just turning a feature flag off and saying we're going to disable that feature while we fix it.
Right.
So those are some of the things that I care about. I also track what functional area postmortems are related to. There's some types of changes that are obviously more inherently risky.
Yeah.
And it's like, what can we do to de-risk the structure or the architecture of that particular part of the application is an interesting question.
Right. How do you measure that?
It's difficult. I do it kind of heuristically. It's like, right, this is related to the payment pipeline, or this is related to how we handle storing data in a particular way, or this is related to, like, quite a few of our postmortems are related to database migrations. It's really, really easy when you're doing live migrations to get ordering wrong or timing wrong or to make assumptions. So,
cool.
Yep.
It sounds like we need to have a further chat on A/B testing in the future. That's a big topic.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of, you know, what benefits you've noted. Now that you have it in the team, you're following this and comparing it to previous roles or from when you started introducing this. Yeah. What did you see change, or what beneficial impacts you've noticed that it makes in the team? We sort of covered some of it, but just to summarize it into a question.
Well, I mean, I think that what I want is I want all of the people in the Pushpay product team to really focus on delivering business value in front of customers as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole bunch of trade-offs in trying to increase the velocity of that, right? Like, how do we get the quality bar high but move quickly? How do we deliver in small increments but not have lots of complexity in terms of trying to build things out in a very piecemeal fashion? And I think one of the things that the blameless postmortems have done for us is just made it safe for people to learn without necessarily feeling like they're taking on a whole bunch of risk.
Right.
Cool.
And you mentioned that for every time you run a postmortem, you have the filled out wiki and then the discussion points. Then do you store them and then you review them to help you detect possible problems that will come up in the future as well?
Yeah, so I review them every month.
Right.
In fact, my team and I review them every month. And we actually produce like a summary of them that goes to the executive and to the board to say, hey, like, here's all the incidents that happened this month. And, you know, they really only care about the material kind of user impacting ones, but we care about all of it. And one of the other things that I report on is like, how are we going in terms of doing mitigations? Because it's really easy for people to speculatively say, oh, it'd be awesome if I had this thing that, you know, made my arm grow back if I cut it off, and then never build it, right, or never do it. So I want to see, are we actually opening mitigations and then closing them in a timely manner? So I've got reports that I look at for that just to say, hey, like, if you're doing a postmortem and you can't realistically achieve the mitigations that you're talking about, then they're not really mitigations, they're just hope, right? Yeah. It's like...
it's waiting
pointless.
For it to happen
Yeah,
again.
That's right, yeah. So we really want to keep on top of that. But I think it's been good just in terms of making sure that people understand their responsibility right. for moving the quality bar forward for everyone. Mm-hmm. So there are mitigation. I've talked quite a bit about metrics and logging and stuff, but a lot of the mitigations that we build are like way pre that. So they're like, oh, like what tests could we add? So this change could never have been introduced right. in the first place. Or yeah. is there something that we can do to our deployment process to make it really, really hard for that particular thing to occur? So we end up getting these layers of protection, mm-hmm. you know, all the way through the system. And that's not like the DevOps team's responsibility or the build engineering team's responsibility. It's like, it's my responsibility. Yeah. If I do this thing and I create the situation, then I should be working to try and figure out how to avoid it. And maybe I don't necessarily have the right background or the right skills, but if we work together to ask the questions, then we can get really good outcomes.
And how do you share with the, cause say if there's a team that deployed a new feature and there was some issue, they figured out what the problem was, you did post-mortem on it.
Yep.
And that was just that team that learns, or how do you share it with everyone else?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. At the moment, we're still small enough that most people are aware enough of what's going on that they would know, oh, this thing. And so it's not perfect, but we also have, so we have these small cross-functional teams that work on like feature teams, basically.
Right.
And then we have a number of guilds that get together. So there's like a platform guild, which is kind of responsible for core platform engineering.
Right.
So if there was something that came up, it would probably be discussed there.
Right.
And we do kind of discuss. Yeah. And then there's a front end guild. So if it was more mitigations related to like front end engineering, JavaScript, CSS, all that stuff, then that would probably go there.
Right.
So there's kind of a number of natural places for those discussions to happen.
Right. Like dotted line teams and
stuff. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very cool. Was there anything else that you wanted to cover on postmortems? It's a huge topic.
Yeah, it is a massive topic. Yeah. I mean, I think for me, it's been really interesting as I've sort of run sessions on it, done training on it with groups, how closely aligned it is to the retrospective practice that Agile teams use. Like these two things for me are just two different sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
You do a retrospective after an iteration or a sprint or whatever, and you do a postmortem after something goes wrong in production. But really, they're very, very closely aligned.
Right.
And so it's been interesting just to see how they've blurred. I feel like, and I actually got this idea off of Donald Reinertsen. I don't know if you know the principles of product development flow, but he's big on lean process, lean. He's actually a manufacturing guy.
Right.
But he did this amazing talk a few years ago where he was like, well, you know, the talk is called The Practical Science of Batch Size. And what he's talking about is how you can optimize for system throughput, whether it's packing cartons or whether it's building software, right?
Right.
If you get your batch size right, you get it not too big and not too small, then you can get a lot more things done through the conveyor belt of the process. And he made this amazing observation that blew my mind. He was like, why would you delay learning until the end of something when you could learn now?
Yeah.
And I was like, so like for me, postmortems are like just-in-time retrospectives. Like, why would I wait for 2 more weeks before I decided we should learn from an incident? Why wouldn't we do it as proximately to the cause of it as we possibly could? And I was like, this makes so much sense to me.
Cool.
So we do some formal retrospectives, but we probably do a lot less than most agile teams because for me, the blameless postmortem practice that we have really functions as a mini retrospective just in time, right?
Yeah. And because you touched on A-B testing before, is that one way that you also make sure that what the problems that you are looking into with the postmortems, they impact less production?
Yeah, so we
as well.
Feature flags really as
feature
opposed to
flags,
A/B
yes.
tests, but yeah, it's the same principle. And yeah, so all code at Pushpay is code reviewed, so you can't get a feature into production without it having gone through a code review and someone else signed it off and saying, yep, this looks good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole bunch of things that code reviewers are looking for, but one of the key things they're looking for is, have you effectively feature flagged the changes that you're doing? So have you minimized the impact to existing code paths? And the idea is that you should always be able to flip back to the previous working code if you're touching something existing. If it's new, obviously it's not too difficult because it's a new thing. You can turn it off, whether it's UI or whatever. But for changes to existing code, we'll take on a bit of technical debt in terms of duplication. We might end up needing to duplicate a method or even a whole service or a whole subsystem in some cases.
Yeah.
But it means that we really, really know that we can always go back to the old behavior really quickly if we need to. And that's just been part of our learning, right? It turns out that when you're doing risky changes, you really, really want to leave stuff you know was working in its current state and only incrementally introduce different things in a way that means you can always roll back. And that means that sometimes it's not that elegant. The engineering isn't that elegant in the short term. And we've had to work with sort of new engineers to say, hey, look, I know this feels ugly. Mm. It's going to look way better in a month's time once you've done this, run it in production, tested it, and then gone back and deleted the old code.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it takes a bit longer, but if you're making payments all the time in real time and we're processing a lot of money flowing through the system all the time, what's your alternative? You can't just be, just blew up $1 million of payments there. Try again next time, you know.
Yeah, cool. It sounds like we need to, we'll try to get you back and drill into that feature a little bit more, because there's a lot to talk about.
Yeah, feature flags are a big subject area. Yeah.
Cool. I think this is it.
Good.
It's a really good topic. Blameless postmortems and part of how it fits into the DevOps process. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
And thanks, everyone. We'll see you again.
See you again.